I am very grateful to the organizers of this school for my possibility to give here these three lectures about my recent research. This is a very nice school, and one pleasant thing is that we can speak about the history, not only about the most recent achievements. And the speakers discussed between themselves what part of history would each of them cover, 19th century, 20th century, but finally we decided we should do it independently, so it will be some repetition. And the oldest result mentioned here yesterday was in the year 1350, something like this. But I would like to start my talk from an even earlier history. In ancient times, there was no zeta function, but there was number theory, and even computational number theory. And Greek mathematician Eratosthenes invented a method for selecting prime numbers among natural numbers. The idea was very simple. We start from numbers starting from 2. 1 is a special number, as you know. We say that 2 is a prime number, and then we select every second number. Now we sieve the numbers which are not underlined. They fell down one level. Now we say that 3 is a prime number. Select every third number, and again allow others to fall down one level. We say that 5 is prime. Select every fifth number. Allow the rest to fall down. Declare 7 to be prime. Select every seventh number, and so on. Finally, all numbers will be placed on several levels, and what depends the level on which particular number would appear. The level depends on the least prime factor of this number. In the top level, we have all even numbers. In the second level, we have all numbers divisible by 3, but not divisible by 2. Next, we have numbers divisible by 5, but not divisible neither by 2 nor by 3, and so on. So, in this way, computations worked in very old time. Next, I would like to say a few words about Euler. It's a pleasure for me to speak about him because he spent great part of his life in St. Petersburg, my native town. This is his famous product, and it gives us a way to use analytical tools to study prime numbers. And yesterday, Professor Sydak showed how we can prove that there are infinitely many primes using Euler product. And even he gave a much better result about divergence of the series of inverse to prime numbers. But actually, there is even a simpler proof of the infinitude of prime numbers based on Euler product. It can be expressed just in one state, in one phrase. If the number of primes would be finite, then the divergent harmonic series would have finite value. A very nice proof, and I believe it is as beautiful as the original proof given by Euclid. Euler was involved in the study of what we now call zeta function by a problem posed by Pietro Mignoli. He asked, what is the sum, what is the value of this sum? In our modern notation, it is just the value of zeta at 2. And the answer was found by Euler. What he did? At first, he calculated this sum with more than 10 decimal digits. It was not easy. He had no access to computers, not even to calculators. And the series converges very slowly. You cannot sum up so many summons to get 10 decimal digits. But Euler invented what we now call Euler-Clorin summation. And you might think that they work together, Euler and Maclaurin, but in fact they invented the same formula independently, and their goals were quite opposite. For Euler, this formula was a method to calculate infinite sum when we can calculate easily integral, and for Maclaurin it was a way to calculate integral when we can find the value of an infinite sum. So somehow Euler knew that this value looks very similar. He made a guess that it should be in fact equal, and in 1735 he gave his first proof of this equality. I usually put it in the quotation marks, because if students would try to present this proof on examinations, they would fail. Because from our today's point of view, it was not quite rigorous. But Euler was very fond of this result, and during his lifetime, he gave several other proofs of this identity, and later were quite rigorous from our point of view. But it was just a starting point, and he continued to study such sums. He found the values of zeta at even points. But then he asked a question which might look strange. What would be the value of zeta at zero? What is the value of 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1? And he gave an answer. Minus 1 half. Very surprising answer. And I would like to explain how he came to this value, because it will be important for understanding the rest of my talk. Actually, he worked not with the zeta itself, but with its multiple, which is now today is usually called Dedekind eta function, but it also could be Euler eta function. If we multiply these two expressions and perform subtractions, then we will obtain an alternating zeta function. It is the same as here, but now we have alternation of signs. The advantage of this alternation summation is that this sum converges for s greater than zero, while original zeta series for zeta function converges only for real part of s greater than one. And the rest was simple. We are interested. Let us substitute 1 here. We would obtain such a series. 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1. I hope you would agree that its value is 1 half. Because it oscillates between 0, 1, 0, 1. And any reasonable method of summation for divergent series would produce the value 1 half. Now if we substitute that 1 half here, and 1 here, it will give us minus 1. And so we obtain that zeta of s should be equal to minus half. But what is important for us is the introduction of this factor. And a few words about this function psi, which was introduced by a Russian mathematician, and his name should be pronounced Chebyshov. Sorry. But many Russians don't know it. This is the standard definition of this function, but I prefer a different definition, which is more number theoretical. This is just logarithm of least common multiple of integers not greater than x. And this is a step function. It has jumps at each prime and also at powers of primes. And in between it is constant. And this is a theorem proved by von Mankelt. He gave such an identity. I would like to give a bit non-standard point of view on this identity. How do we understand it? We have a quality, this well-defined left-hand side and right-hand side. It has a free parameter x, and if we substitute a particular value for x, we would obtain the same value on the left and on the right. But let us imagine that we know nothing about prime numbers at all, even the definition of prime numbers. But we know that a function, we have a powerful computer, we can calculate its zeros. And we start making plots. We cannot make infinite summation, but we can find finite sum. Here summation is up to zeros, not greater in absolute value than 50. We obtain some this blue curve, which looks approximately like the step function. If we take more summons for absolute value less than 100, we get a better approximation. For 200, even better. For 100, almost ideal. So, we can say the following. We know nothing about prime numbers, but we made such calculations, few calculations, found zeros of the zeta function, and began to make such summations. And we notice that we approach some step function which has jumps at particular points. And these particular points are just prime numbers and their powers. So I say that we can discover prime numbers via zeros of the zeta function. Or, in other words, the zeros encode prime numbers in a very involved way, but nevertheless, they appear here quite clearly. And even zeros encode prime numbers in two ways. Instead of looking at points where I have jumps, we could look at the sizes of jumps. And we would see that the jumps are always logarithms of natural numbers, and these natural numbers are exactly prime numbers. So this is a second way in which zeros of zeta function encodes prime numbers. And now I can start my talk properly. So we have our favorite zeta function. Computationally, we cannot make infinite summation. We might bound ourselves by something finite. For example, we can just cut this infinite sum at some point. But already, okay. The first day, Lee told us that there was an approach to study zeta function via these finite sums. There was a theorem by Turan, given a sufficient condition for the Riemann hypothesis in terms of the distribution of zeros of this finite sum. But Montgomery spoiled this approach. He proved that this necessary condition does not hold. So it's not so useful to study exactly this finite sum, because it does not converge, the series does not converge inside the critical line where we are interested to look for zeros. But instead, we can just consider a general finite Dirichlet series with some coefficients. We will be interested in zeros, so we can always make normalization, and I will suppose that the leading coefficient is 1, so our series looks like this. And here we have a freedom of selecting n minus 1 coefficient. How should we select these numbers? What do we want from this finite sum? We would be happy to get some knowledge about zeros of zeta function. So we would be happy if zeros of this sum would be close to the zeros of the zeta function. Zeros come in conjugate pairs, and believing in the Riemann hypothesis, we can write them as 1/2 plus something purely imaginary, and again we can assume also that these zeros are simple. And my idea was very trivial and very naive. I said, let us select for n an odd number, 2n plus 1, and let us demand that we want that our finite sum should vanish at m pairs of conjugate zeros. So instead of taking a finite series and looking what are its zeros, I take zeros and say I want to study finite Dirichlet series with these prescribed zeros. Well, it looks like stupid, but if you have a computer, it's not difficult nowadays to calculate, and it turns out very interesting. But before discussing what happens here, let us consider two more familiar situations. Very trivial case if we have a polynomial. We have a polynomial. I will assume that the free coefficient is not zero. It has n zeros, and for simplicity I will assume that all of them are simple. Then the polynomial can be written as a product over factors depending on these zeros. So in the case of polynomial, zeros completely determine the polynomial. A bit more complicated situation is with Taylor series of an entire function. We have infinite series. Again, I assume that this coefficient is not zero. Now we have infinitely many zeros. Again, I assume that they are simple. And if our function is, so to say, a good function, I will not go into details, it can be expanded into an infinite product. We want to deal with only finitely many zeros, so we can consider finite product. It will be a polynomial with some coefficients. And if our function is good, then this coefficient would approach the coefficients of our original series. So let us return to Dirichlet series. Our goal is to find such a finite sum that would vanish at these zeros. How could we find such a sum? In fact, it's easy because this is just a system of linear equations, and we can consider such determinant. It has rows corresponding to numbers 1, 2, 3, n, up to capital N, and columns corresponding to zeros and their conjugates. Up to the last column, where there are expressions depending on this S. Clearly, if S is equal to one of these zeros or its conjugate, then you would have two equal columns and the determinant would vanish. And syntactically, this is a finite Dirichlet series. You can just expand it according to the last column. It will be a finite sum with some coefficients. It's not exactly what we wanted, because I wanted to have here the coefficient equal to 1, so we need just to make normalization, to divide all coefficients by the first one, and in this way we obtain the desired finite series. The question was, my first question, whether would this coefficient would approach once the coefficients of the Dirichlet series for zeta function. And now I will show you the coefficients in the case when the capital N is equal to 17. What do you expect to see? Let's have a look. So we see that at first coefficients are close to 1, but then they gradually diminish. So it looks like rather plausible that the coefficients should approach the coefficients of the zeta function. So our capital delta is such a sum, and I will use such a very strange notation. I will use this harpoon sign, and it will have the following very, very weak meaning. It says that two Dirichlet series have several initial coefficients close one to another. A very, very weak kind of similarity between two Dirichlet series. Okay, let us compare the values of zeta on the critical line and our finite sum. In red we have zeta, in blue we have our finite sum, and we see that at the origin they look very different, but then they are very close. You cannot distinguish blue and red, you see just violet, but later they also became separate. So just the 17 terms gave a very good approximation to the zeta function inside the critical strip, which was rather surprising, but pleasant. And I continued my calculations and calculated determinants of size 101. What do you expect to see here? No similarity at all. Of course, the blue lines pass through the zeros which you use to define this sum, but otherwise they are very, very different. Why? Let us look how coefficients behave. They are quite different. Coefficients with odd second index are close to 1, but even are close to minus 1. And when I first saw this picture after previous calculations, I decided that there was a mistake in my calculations. Why it changed so sharply? But in fact, explanation is rather simple. Let us consider what would happen if we have not an entire function, but a meromorphic function having some poles. We do exactly the same. Would the coefficients approach the coefficients of this series? No. They don't know anything about this denominator. The coefficients would approach some numbers b, that come from numerator here. A numerator is just our series multiplied by this denominator. So zeros here know nothing about poles, and we cannot expect that they would catch the coefficients a sub n, which depends both on zeros and poles. So it's not surprising that we got something different from the approaching numbers 1. And now we can say something different. A new conjecture was that the coefficient would approach minus 1 to power n plus 1. It might be true, but it might be not so easy to prove, because very often there are such strange effects like this one. Indeed, originally coefficients are close to plus 1 and minus 1, but before vanishing they grow up. Or even like this. They were plus minus 1, then suddenly jump and change the side. I would like to show you more such pictures. I will show you several hundred pictures. So be patient. So the picture more or less stabilizes, but every now and then there are some strange peaks. So let us assume that this is true. What does it mean for our finite sums? Now it is similar to the alternating zeta function. Again, on some initial range of n, of lowercase n. And this function is just Euler Dedekind eta function, which is a multiple of zeta function. So it was not surprising that we got a very bad picture. And now we know that we should compare our finite sum with this product, with eta function. And now we have ideal coincidence. So here there is the first intriguing question. Why is this factor? Euler was a clever mathematician and he invented this factor for his purposes. Here we used a stupid computer and performed just mechanical calculations. And nevertheless, we got the same factor. In fact, there are many finite sums which could cancel the power of zeta. Why exactly is this? And it will be my suggestion for the exercises to consider possibilities of different factor canceling the pole. I will tell more details later in the special session. Okay, it was very nice coincidence. But it was inside the critical strip where alternating theories converges. Bartin turned out that there is a good coincidence even if you go on the real line to the left of the critical strip. This finite sum has a zero close to minus 2, minus 4, but then they go differently. And if we take a bigger capital N, then the coincidence is better up to here. So it's a strange effect that non-trivial zeros somehow know about trivial zeros. Constructing these sums, we used only non-trivial zeros. And the sum we obtained has zeros close to trivial zeros. Why? Let us look again at our previous picture, because it will be clearly there. We see that this finite sum passes through the 8 zeros used for its construction. But the coincidence is rather good on some distance after. And actually, there are zeros close to other non-trivial zeros not used in the construction. And here is just an example. We take for m 3550, that is n equal to 3101. And this finite sum vanishes very close to this zero, which we did not use in constructing this delta. They have more than 1,000 common decimal digits. We can go further and if we jump 200 zeros, the approximation is not as good, but still more than 800 common digits between zeta and our finite sum. And so on. As we go further and further, approximation is not as good as before, but still very impressive. And also for such large value of n, there is a good approximation to the trivial zeros. Here we have zero up to 1,500 decimal digits, and so on. And let us return for the moment to the meromorphic function. Here, when we cancel poles, we multiply by this denominator, we just cancel poles and do nothing else. And this extra factor is defined in a unique way by the poles of the series. But when we multiply our zeta by this finite Dirichlet series, of course, we have killed the pole, but we also added a lot of other zeros, because this function vanishes when s is of this form, for k equal to 0 plus minus 1 and so on. The value k equal to 0 cancels the pole, but we got extra zeros for different values of k greater than 0. And nevertheless, our finite series approximates these zeros, these values, that are due to this factor, which is outside zeta. So we can summarize as follows. Zeta zeros are very knowledgeable. They know about the initial trivial zeros. They know about other non-trivial zeros not used in the construction of our finite sums. And they know about the pole, because they have extra zeros corresponding to this factor that cancels the pole. And nothing similar can happen for the meromorphic function. If we used finitely many zeros, we cannot say anything about other zeros. Their finite number of zeros does not contain any information, anything else about themselves. Why it's so different here? Yesterday, Hamburger theorem was mentioned. There we have very simple analytical condition, the functional equation, and another condition that the functions are represented by Dirichlet series. And I believe that the same is here. It is very important that our function is defined by Dirichlet series. In the general case, this hardly would work. There are many ways to experiment here and to see what happens. And I will just mention one experiment that you can easily extend it and see what happens. So we have Euler product, and let's consider similar function when we use all factors except the very first. We exclude p equal to 2. This will be such a sum. It is equivalent to multiplying by this factor. just without two here. So now we have extra zeros of this factor. Let us take 100 pairs of conjugate zeros with zeta function and 200 zeros of this factor, which are of this form, and calculate similar deltas. What do you expect to see? So we calculate 400 two determinants. We know them in this way to say that we dropped 2, used 200 zeros of zeta, and the total size is 402. This is the picture. Rather surprising. So before we saw that position of points depended on the parity. Now the behavior modulo 4 is important. So the odd coefficients start the same from 1, then they go to close to 0, and so this is as before. But those divisible by 4 start from close to 0, and at some point they jump to 1. And those that are congruent to 2 modulo 4 start at minus 2, then jump to minus 1. Why such behavior? It is possible to understand what happens at the very beginning. At the very beginning, the coefficients are close to coefficients of this product. So we use zeta, we use this factor, and we know that this factor appears to cancel the pole. And if you multiply this three series, you will get exactly what is here, 1, 0, and minus 2. But at some point, there is a switch, and now coefficients approach the coefficients of this product. So this 1 somehow drops. And later, the coefficients are again very small. I don't have any explanation why such a complicated structure in this case. You can play with different number of zeros of zeta function and different number of the zeros from this extra factor and see how pictures changes. Okay, so what do we see here? Not very much. We see that these numbers are approximately 1 and approximately minus 1. But you can guess that they are not exactly 1 and minus 1. And so now we want to study this in more details. Let us subtract this plus or minus 1 and consider such a difference. And the coefficients look like this. Now they split into 4 series. Red one splits here and here, and blue splits here and here. And you can roughly see that the distance between red lines and blue lines looks the same. And you can also guess that this is 1/3 of this difference. And in fact, if you look at the numerical values, you will see that this quantity is like this, and this is like this. They are of the same order, and their ratio is very close to minus 3 over 2. They have more than 100 common digits. So this is a kind of relationship between zeros of zeta functions, because these deltas were calculated from the zeros. And in fact, there are many, many almost linear relations between these deltas. For example, if we look at the coefficient 4, which is here, it is close to minus 1, and it is more natural to subtract these two close numbers, and we see that they are very close. Indeed, they have almost 200 common digits. And if you remember that this ratio was almost 3 over 2 with this difference, if you add this and this, you will get almost this quantity. And indeed, we consider such a ratio is very close to 2/3, to minus 2/3. We can continue and consider relationship between the first 5 deltas. If we consider such relation, we see that this ratio is very close to minus 5 over 12. And we can do it in a more systematical way by introducing some notation. We can introduce such linear combinations of our deltas. K mu is the Mendel's function. And we make summation over all m dividing n, and obtain some quantities n with two indexes. This is the definition of Mendel's function. And these are explicit expressions for these quantities. This is just one, this is like this, our difference, and so on. And we can also, okay, and here are just numerical values of this mu for the case of n equal to 2001. We see that these quantities are very small and go smaller and smaller. It again implies that there are almost linear relations between our deltas. Moreover, we can introduce other quantities to make such finite summations of our mu numbers divided by m. And it turned out that the ratios of these numbers is very, very close to minus 1. And now I can say about the origin of my yesterday's continued fraction. So we have these numbers, mu and nu. I took L equal to 2520. This is just least common multiple of the first 10 numbers. I calculated this number and found this expansion. That was rather surprising, as I explained, because we have at first rather large numbers here, while according to the metric theorem, almost all elements of continued fractions of a random real number are ones, two or three, but very, very small. And also here we have a very fine structure. All these numbers are easily expressible in terms of our number L. So when I saw such a nice continued fraction, I decided to introduce this function phi of L just by this formal expression. When L has many small factors, this will be integers. After some point, they won't be integers, but nevertheless, we can continue refraction. And with some guesses, I found that this continuous fraction should be equal to this difference, where psi is the logarithmic derivative of the gamma function. And having got such an expression, I've got a possibility to calculate this function for every value of L. And indeed, this number nu, which is a linear combination of our deltas, is very close to the value of this function. We have more than 100 common digits. If we take a number which don't have so many prime factors, nevertheless, approximation is very good. It is even better because we have a greater number. And in the numerator, we have two numbers with difference 1. In the denominator, only one number. And it turned out that the second index here is more important. If I take, okay, this is just another example, but if I take capital N 7001, but will make summation only up to 6000, nevertheless, this function approximates also very good. So, how this function is connected with zeta zeros, it's not clear at all. And later I learned that actually this is just a special case of what is called Lerch function. And I don't know whether this expansion was known before or not. And as I showed yesterday, I found also two other series of such expansions. And it would be interesting to find expression for, to find an expression in the form of continuous fraction for general function with three parameters. Here we have a special value for the first two parameters, because this function also gives the zeta function. Okay, I will stop for today at this place.